Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello, and welcome back to the Bunker Daily. I'm Aisha Hazarika. The UK's vaccine rollout has been heralded as a success in pandemic policy, but not everyone is as enthusiastic as we all might wish. Vaccine confidence is routinely up to 20% lower in Black and Asian and minority ethnic communities. Up to 72% of Black people are unlikely to take the COVID vaccine, with Pakistani and Bangladeshi individuals the next most hesitant ethnic groups. And vaccine hesitancy is a matter of life or death. Black people and Pakistani and Bangladeshi men are nearly twice as likely to die from COVID than white people. The number of BAME patients in intensive care is three times that of their proportion of the population. And new research identifies ethnicity and socioeconomic deprivation as long COVID risk factors. To talk about this, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Salman Wakar, General Secretary of the British Islamic Medical Association and a practicing GP. He has also recently set up a COVID vaccination site in his local area. Hello, Salman. How are you? And welcome to the Bunker Daily.
Hi, Aisha. Glad to be here. Thank you.
So you're a passionate, vocal advocate for vaccination, and you had your own jab back in December. Beyond the sore arm, how did you find it?
It was absolutely fine. I mean, like most of us, I've had all my vaccines in childhood. And as a medic, we also have to have regular vaccinations just to stay up to date with things like hepatitis and other diseases. And it was no different to that. In fact, it was a lot quicker because I didn't have to wait around in the waiting room as I normally do. A bit of a sore arm afterwards, but no, I didn't have any side effects afterwards. So I was very pleased with that.
Brilliant. And you didn't feel that Bill Gates was controlling your mind straight afterwards or anything like that?
I wish.
That would really help me if Bill Gates could control my mind. I think that's a... So, Salman, tell us and our listeners, what is vaccine hesitancy and why is it higher amongst Black, Asian and minority ethnic communities?
Well, very simply put, it's people being uncertain about either the vaccine itself or the effect of the vaccine on their bodies and the disease that it's trying to fight. In terms of why it's more of a problem or an issue amongst non-white communities, it's quite complex, but it's also helpful to understand some of the context, actually. If you look at Europe pre-COVID, some European countries actually were more vaccine hesitant than other parts of the developing world. France, for instance, has had quite a lot of problems with convincing their population to take, you know, the routine vaccinations. And we've had problems as well in this country with MMR, for instance. It's not just a problem or an issue that is affecting minority communities. The issues that have come to the fore with the COVID pandemic have been very much around the lens of structural inequalities. So when we go to these communities and we say, this vaccine is important, it's going to help you save your lives and indeed your livelihoods, given the economic inequalities that are also experienced by these communities. A lot of them won't accept what you're saying at face value, because in the past, they've experienced structural exclusion from the health system. So if you take a Black woman, for instance, Black women are more likely to die during childbirth than white women are. And that's been the case for many years. It's not just COVID that's brought that to light. And so is it surprising then that Black women and Black communities are hesitant or uncertain? And then the same is true for other communities that you mentioned. So the Pakistani community, the Bengali community have experienced similar levels of structural exclusion from society and the system not being quite set up to cater for them. Compounding this, of course, is the difficulty that we've got with this anti-vax community. They have been exploiting that vulnerability that these communities have from not by that vacuum being there, by there not being community champions, there not being materials in their languages or in their context. So it is a bit of a complex picture, but the good thing is that we have started to see a lot of movement from the government, from local authorities, from public health bodies, and from clinical commissioners to actually start and address this. And we are seeing, at least on the ground, a lot more people from a Black and Asian minority ethnic background coming forward and getting the vaccine.
Yeah, as you see, the reasons for the hesitancy, they're quite complicated, they're quite multi-layered. And I think you're absolutely right. The sort of historical mistrust that a lot of, you know, Black and Asian communities have in not just the NHS, but lots of bigger institutions as well, is definitely a factor. I mean, I was quite struck that there's a lot of attention focused on this. Lots of ethnic minority activists and celebrities like Adil Ray and Mira Sayal, who all took to social media to encourage people to take up the vaccine. We've been seeing ethnic minority doctors, you know, vlogging their vaccinations on TikTok, in Urdu. Why is this important? And more importantly, is it effective? Will it move the needle to get the needle into people's arms?
So just on the point of getting celebrities involved, I think it's really helpful to see people in the public eye talking about you know, the vaccine and addressing some of those issues. And there's definitely a social capital that is gained with that. It creates a conversation. It opens up parts of it opens up conversation really in families and in communities. So that is incredibly helpful. But what some of the research suggests is that actually it may not be as helpful, or sometimes may be perceived as a tick box or as people that don't really represent me. So Adil Ray is a wonderful comedian, but does he speak to every Pakistani? Does Marcus Rashford, a very successful young footballer, speak to every young Black man in Britain? And the answer is probably not. What we are seeing is a lot of response to local trusted individuals. That can be people from sort of faith traditions, so imams, priests, rabbis, and that has actually been quite effective because a lot of people take their direction from that aspect of their identity and their lives. But then there are also other people that are not part of a religious community, but they have other influential voices, not just in the UK, but also abroad. And that's another thing that local communities have been doing, given the sort of media that these communities consume. So the Polish community, for example, may not necessarily watch, and I'm stereotyping here, of course, but the people that are underserved or find it difficult to consume the media and the messages that are coming out from the governments and public health authorities may find that actually if we engage with a Polish channel based in Poland, they may be actually better informed if we go through that lens. So in terms of its effectiveness, it's difficult to give a straight answer to that because we haven't actually done a great deal of research into this in the way that we have perhaps researched other areas. And that in itself is an issue. Historically, you know, we haven't really prioritized research into ethnic minorities and particularly into looking at how we can capture and make best use of community assets like places of worship, like community champions. And another thing that's sort of compounding all this is data. We've only recently started collecting very granular real-time data around which ethnicities are getting the vaccine. So we're in a much better position now than when we were in December when we started.
And in terms of that early granular data that you've seen, what are you picking up in terms of which groups are coming forward and which groups aren't?
So age is an important factor here. So we're seeing that the elderly community, which are more at risk, they have been the most enthusiastic to get the vaccine done, partly because they have probably been the ones that have been most affected by lockdown, in that they themselves or their loved ones are hesitant to let them go out and engage with society. So there's a lot of enthusiasm from them. And we saw a lot of people, you know, very keen to come in. I've seen patients that were crying, and that was the first time that they'd been out since March 2020. They didn't even go out during the summer because they weren't sure. The younger cohorts, as we're coming into those people who have got long-term health conditions but are younger, there is a little bit of issues there still, because of perhaps there is some complacency that they don't see COVID affecting them. In terms of ethnicity, what we are hearing from colleagues in public health and in NHS England is that we are seeing improvements, and data that I have heard of is suggesting that in non-white groups, we are seeing positive indicators that we are seeing greater uptake in recent weeks than previous weeks.
Okay. Well, I mean, and you're also right about the campaign. It is a really good campaign, and it's great to see people come together. I was also struck as well, a lot of parliamentarians from all sides of the House, Labour and Conservative. What was interesting is to see, you know, Black and Asian MPs from Labour and the Conservative Party coming together to get the message out, you know, people who are normally sort of at each other's throats, but saying, look, let's come together. But you're right. I think the sort of lazy way to do this for a lot of politicians, and I myself have been on the other side of politics, is because they don't really understand ethnic minority communities, and just the term BAME, it's just like lumping everybody together and think everybody will watch the One Show or the BBC and then that will be like job done. And the other thing that I'm interested in is, how is take up amongst Black and Asian and minority ethnic people who work in the NHS? Is that a high take-up, or is there hesitancy amongst NHS workers from those communities as well?
There is uncertainty in the workforce as well, no doubt about it. And I think that just reflects the fact that we're not divorced from our communities. You know, and that in itself speaks to a bit of a paradox, isn't it? You'd expect people who work in the health and social care community and they've seen the sharp end of COVID, that you would then still find it unappealing to take the vaccine. And I think that, you know, unpicking that is also quite important. And when you speak to people in that space, it again, the same issues are there. So it's the fact that a lot of this workforce has been struggling to have its voice heard. There's an important piece of work called the Workforce Race Equality Standards that was set up in England by the NHS, looking at the amount, the proportion of non-white leadership in the NHS compared to the number of staff that work for that institution. And consistently, you're not seeing non-white people promoted beyond a certain level. There appears to be a glass ceiling. And that's been the case for many years, and there's been lots of movements to try and get that fixed, but we're still not seeing that representation of that workforce and all of the richness that comes from the different blend of identities and ethnicities and all that intersectionality that exists being represented in a management, in a board level, in these institutions. And so, you know, you compound that with other reports of bullying and harassment being reported amongst BAME staff members. And it kind of, you know, one of the reasons might be, and again, this is something that we do need more data and more research, but one of the reasons might be that these staff members, again, just don't trust what their matrons, their clinical directors, their chief executives are telling them to do, because they feel they feel disenfranchised from their employer. And then that's compounded with the government aspect as well.
Well, it feeds back into what we began our conversation talking about, which was a lot of mistrust that Black and Asian and minority ethnic people often have in health institutions and indeed, you know, governmental institutions. And, you know, in a post-Windrush era, you can completely understand why that mistrust is there. That representation is so important. And tell me, Salman, what about your own experiences, you know, as a Muslim man in the health service? You know, have you experienced discrimination or out and out right racism?
So I've been very fortunate. You pointed out the fact that I'm a man. So I have male privilege. I'm quite conscious of that. So, there has been low grade stuff for me in sort of, you know, people wash it off as banter and then you perhaps look back and you think, well, perhaps maybe it wasn't. There was one incident quite recently, actually. We've just had a baby boy recently.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And just after he was born, I was alone with him. My wife had to be elsewhere. And one of the colleagues, one of the nurses, excuse me, came in. And the first thing she said to me was, "Do you speak English?" And I was like, "Pardon, I'm not quite sure what you mean by that." And she said, "Oh, you never know these days." And then she was very matter of fact about it. And then I kind of, I was a bit sleep deprived and just sort of said whatever. But this is me as someone who is a fairly well established clinician, middle class, and I'm still getting this stuff. And these sort of microaggressions and micro compromises, they're not, you speak to anyone. People who are disabled, people who are, to women, of course, and people who are pregnant, LGBTQI communities, everyone will talk about this. It is a difficult conversation to have because it does create a little bit of tension between you and the people that you're trying to engage with, but it's an important one. And I think COVID has shown us that, if we don't address these issues, this elephant in the room as a society, it is a fracture that can lead to quite a devastating break in society. And I think it is important for us to also mention that we kind of talk about all these inequalities, forgetting that actually the biggest killer in COVID is economic deprivation. And it happens to be that the minority communities are more poor, and people who are just about managing and their carers and they've got learner disabilities. I think that is somewhat lost in all this. And we're just about managing to talk about ethnicity, but we're not talking about poverty. And I think that is something that we do need to bring back to the table. Because if we don't, we're going to miss a huge opportunity to try and build back, not only better, but also build back fairer. Because I think that is something that we have to get right. Otherwise, we're just going to be in the same problem, but with another disease. And we're not going to be anywhere different, in the next 10 years.
What I really noticed with the sort of narrative around Black and Asian and minority ethnic people, at first there was almost like a hope or a desire that there was some sort of biological or genetic thing. I remember having discussions with people probably more to the right of politics than me, and they were saying, I think it's something to do with vitamin D, and it's something to do with diabetes, because South Asian people have diabetes, and so this has got to be something to do with diabetes. And almost hoping it was something to do with diabetes. And now, as you say, when you join up the dots, it's things like overcrowded housing, it's the kinds of employment which mean that Black and Asian people are more exposed to the virus, whether it was public transport or working in shops or carers or frontline NHS staff, all of those kind of things. But how do you think we should move the conversation on to properly address those things, to join up those dots in society and have those difficult conversations?
I think, it's a very important point that you made. So diabetes, cardiovascular disease in particular, we kind of, it's almost become a shorthand thing for saying that, this person is from a non-white background. It's important that we recognize that for a lot of people, these diseases are socially patterned. It's because we've got an economic system that doesn't allow people to eat healthily, doesn't allow people to live in a way where they're not under constant stress, which causes their body to produce too much stress hormones, which causes you to put on weight. That sort of complex sort of situation causes you to have more mental health problems, which means that you have problems accessing the employment sector, et cetera, et cetera. We have to start investing in, prevention and education and all these boring things. But actually, these are the things that end up yielding the greatest benefit for society. All the things that we've done in COVID, or recently at least, have started to do in COVID, which is to reach out to communities, to co-produce, to recognize that we don't have all the answers, and we have to let go of a bit of the central command and control and give that to, you know, to local people who are trusted and have the best interests of the community at heart. You know, big society.
that's a phrase I haven't heard for a while.
it does yield benefits. I'm not suggesting that's a panacea, but that approach is something that we have struggled or been reluctant to engage with. And certainly from, you know, from speaking as a Muslim person as well, faith and the role of faith and places of worship has been something that we've found difficult to discuss as a country. And for many years, so this isn't anything recent. This is since the Enlightenment, of course. But it's something that we have to recognize that it is a huge part of people's identity as well. And the involvement of chaplains and people in the sort of spiritual care setting has been fundamental, given the moral and spiritual injury that we have suffered, not as a nation, but also people as on the front line as well. So that, you know, that conversation hopefully will start developing in a mature and in a productive way as well. But it has to be, you know, led in a framework that is about building back fairer.
Yeah, and it would be such a lost opportunity if this was not a teachable moment in terms of moving society onwards. Now, you mentioned the importance of faith. You yourself are from a Muslim background, as am I. How did you feel when Eid was cancelled very suddenly, whereas Christmas was treated more carefully and more sensitively and was much more at the centre of a national conversation?
Yeah, I think there is very little doubt that the Christmas bubble policy was something that has led to the situation that we're in. Of course, you know, it's not just Eid, Passover, Vaisakhi, Easter. Lots of other traditions have also and celebrations have also been affected. Certainly on the Eid front, it was very, I think a lot of people were hurt by that. And again, I don't think anyone would have been too upset had it been a decision that was given with adequate notice. But it was literally on Christmas Eve, but it was on Eid Eve. Yeah. It's not that that exists, but that decision was made. And I think that's what hurt the most, not the fact that Eid was cancelled. I think people would have understood that, you know, rates were rising, that this is not wise. You know, mosques for the first time, I think ever in Islamic history, have, you know, coordinated a closure across the world in response to something like this for this sort of length of time. So it's not that the community and faith leaders were being lemmings and just wanting to go ahead and celebrate without any cause for concern for what might happen. If anything, actually, the Muslim community and indeed many other minority communities have been incredibly resilient and proactive. So I think there has been a lot of hurt. And I think there is this perception that, some communities only matter when they're a problem, rather than there being a sort of equal partnership. And yeah, I think that is something that, you know, a lot of people have had a bit of a bitter taste in their mouth about.
Mm. Now, I just want to, just a few final questions that I want to put to you. One of the concerns that some of the community had, particularly Muslim community, was that there was rumours that the Pfizer vaccine was not halal, that it could have contained gelatin or alcohol. What did you and your organisation do to help clarify that and debunk that myth?
So I think the issue about whether something is halal or not is a discussion or a decision for Islamic scholars, people who've studied the Islamic sciences and are able to make that decision. So what we went away and did was looked at the vaccines themselves and their ingredients and put that information forward to these bodies to make those decisions. And the Pfizer vaccine, for instance, has got no products in there that are of concern to Islamic scholars. The AstraZeneca vaccine does have a very small amount of alcohol, but it's no more than a slightly aged banana that's undergone a little bit of fermentation, or orange juice. If you leave it out for a couple of days, it starts to ferment and there's a very trace amount of alcohol in there. So the issue was, I guess, more around the genesis of vaccines, and the production of vaccines, and whether or not, for example, the genetic modification that is used and is used in many other medicines and not just vaccines, but also put it in the context of the public health issue that Muslim communities are facing, given the fact that we knew that the Muslim community in Britain had been disproportionately affected in terms of lives and livelihoods, and the fact that we also had a particular way of going about doing things, whether it's a social gatherings with Ramadan and Friday prayers, for instance. So we put that all together and put that out there in position statements and started engaging with the Islamic institutions, the Muslim Council of Britain and other mosques and other influential Muslim faith leaders. And now with Ramadan coming up, we're doing a similar thing to try and reassure Muslim communities that, you know, even during Ramadan, taking a vaccine, it doesn't break your fast. And that's the opinion of Muslim scholars, and that people shouldn't delay getting it on the account of Ramadan.
That's really interesting, really interesting. And then final question, as you keep tracking the data that comes in, looking at different age groups and different ethnicities, may there come a point where door-to-door vaccinations in deprived areas where there are high concentrations of particular minority groups who are slow at coming forward? Do you think that's something that the government should consider?
I think nothing should be left off the table. And this might be one of them. You know, we're also seeing pop-up centres come up in places of worship, for instance. You know, why not have a pop-up centre that comes up in another area where people congregate, or, you know, supermarket, for example, where there is a particular issue of low uptake. And again, it's important to remember that the low uptake isn't only going to be in BAME communities. It's also amongst other white communities as well. So for the traveller community, for example, you know, they've had issues with vaccine uptake as well. You know, I recently just spoke to a very affluent middle class lady who is also very vaccine reluctant because she's not convinced about the data. So yeah, you know, going around and getting vaccines in a bus. We've seen that happen in Crawley, actually, in London. There's been a bus that's been driving around to homeless shelters and places of worship to give vaccines to people who may find it difficult to get them. There's a vaxi-taxi in Harrow, I think, which is a retrofitted black cab.
Oh, I love that, the vaxi-taxi. Or maybe the jab cab.
There you go. We should trademark that. But so there's some really cool and innovative things that are happening. And I must stress, actually, that these innovations have come from the NHS, from within GP practices and from people working in the health service who have the answers. And that innovation isn't something that we've necessarily seen from places where we've had to outsource to non-NHS bodies, for instance, to the test and trace situation and the laboratory situation, which I think is a separate conversation in and of itself. But I think it's important we pay testament to the creativity and the huge work that GPs and primary care colleagues have put to make sure that, you know, they do get all of their communities vaccinated.
Yeah, who knew that actually the NHS was quite good at doing this kind of stuff and not outsourcing it was the way forward. Listen, it's been such a pleasure to have you on the show. Final question, Salman, what are you most looking forward to doing when some kind of normality can resume?
So I'd love for my son to actually meet his aunt. He's not actually done that yet. So yeah, I'd love the family to get together. I think that is something I think a lot of us have missed and taken for granted. So yeah, just a hug will do, I think. So yeah, here's hoping.
Here's hoping that's a lovely way to end this. Dr. Salman Waqar, a practicing GP and General Secretary of the British Islamic Medical Association, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me on The Bunker.
Thank you.
Listeners, remember there's a new Bunker Daily every Wednesday, Thursday and Friday with Start Your Week on Mondays and the main panel show on Tuesdays. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss out on any new episodes. You can also back The Bunker on the crowdfunding platform Patreon. Just see our Twitter or Facebook or search Patreon Bunker Podcast. See you next time.
The Bunker Daily was presented by Aisha Hazarika and the producer was Andrew Harrison. Assistant producers were Jacob Archbold and Yelena Sofronovich, and audio production was from me, Robin Lieber. The Bunker theme tune is by Kenny Dickinson, and The Bunker Daily is a Bob Masters production.